White Rocket Entertainment.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Episode 003, David Michelinie on the Avengers.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net in association with the Earth Station One Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and in this episode, we return to my interview with legendary Marvel, DC, and other writer David Michelinie. As you probably know if you're listening to this show, David wrote probably the epical, seminal Iron Man run, and then did it again later, back in the late 70s and the mid-80s. He's also famous as one of the major Avengers writers, and he wrote for several years Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man, which we'll talk about in this part of the interview. And, of course, he famously created Venom, among others, and we talk about that in this section, too. He's also the author of the great Avengers novel, The Man Who Stole Tomorrow, and he also adapted Jim Shooter's Ultron short story or novella from one of the books in that series into Avengers issues 201 and 202. So David is truly a legend in the comics universe for certain. I was thrilled to have him on the show. So without further ado, we go right back into that interview where we now start talking about the Avengers. Let's get into the Avengers a little bit then. So while you're writing Iron Man, you did various things with the Avengers. Now, you've already said that you scripted over Shooter's plots maybe a little bit during the Korvac saga. What was it like to come onto the Avengers in the middle of just this gargantuan, year-long, humongous, all the Avengers are going to get killed at the end story?
It was actually a wonderful learning experience. It was the best thing that could have happened to me because I read Marvel almost exclusively before I started writing comics. But then when I got into DC, I had so much to learn about that that universe and the characters and stuff. I read not that many Marvels, so I go in and I'm given these pages to script. And there's no written plot because at the time, Jim Shooter was so busy. He would work out the plot, and he would get the penciler on the phone, and he would tell him the plot. And the penciler would take notes, and then he would draw it. Well, I'm giving these 17 pages of script. There's no plot. So what am I going to do? So Jim walked me through it, page after page. These are the characters. And it was such an education, because he knew the characters so well, how they would stand, how they would act, reply to something, and he would tell me everything about these characters. I learned so much about the characters just through the three stories I did over his oral plots that when I finished writing those, I could write the Avengers myself because I knew the book. I knew the characters so well. So it was a terrific learning experience, and it was a challenge, and it was a lot of fun. It was a good thing.
Well, it definitely shows because I don't think that anybody would disagree that one of your absolute strengths writing the Avengers was getting all their personalities, not only getting them right, but meshing so well. The chemistry among the characters. I mean, obviously people talk about to this day, talk about the Beast and Wonder Man, but just all the characters and their interactions, their personalities and their conversations, when they're not fighting a villain even, was so sharp. And there was a lot of humor that you brought into the book too, here and there, kind of in the cracks. So, you know, what are your thoughts when I say that? That, I mean, it's these funny conversations, these strong personalities, all that. I mean, was that all just kind of you absorbed it from talking to Shooter, or what were you bringing? You know, go with that. I'm asking a terrible question.
That's okay. I'll give you a terrible answer. Uh-huh. Okay, I a lot of what I understood about the characters came from Jim Shooter. That was my core. Mm-hmm. When I started plotting it and scripting it myself, I think if I wrote an obituary in the newspaper, there would be a couple of jokes in it. I don't think I can do anything without humor. It's just a part of what I am and a part of what I write. So that came out there. But I specifically, there were so many, I think this is the first team book I ever wrote, and I wasn't as comfortable with big groups as I am with single characters and a supporting cast. But so many of the groups, as I recall, were filled with bickering, you know, and conflict. And I thought, this is a team. You know, they're going to have differences, but they're a team. They work together. Why don't I have them like each other just to be different? So that was my take. I wanted them to be work together, to have each other's backs. They could differ in their opinions, but especially when they're a team and they're working together, you know, they're one unit and like a good SEAL team, you know, they hang out together and they understand each other and they're tolerant. I just wanted to have most of these people be good people and be friends. And so that's kind of where my take on the characters came from.
Well, were there any particular characters you really had a good time using that, and were there any that you wish you could have had in the team? Well, because honestly, let's back up. When you took over full-time 181, you had basically every Avenger just about there ever was and the Guardians of the Galaxy, and the first thing you did was throw all but seven out the window, more or less. So was that an editorial decision told to you, or were you just wanting to narrow it down and not have so many characters to deal with?
It was probably me, although it could have been something between Jim and I talking. But, yeah, I didn't want 400 characters, you know. I mean, George Perez would have loved drawing it because he could draw so many characters, you know. But I didn't want to write that many. And someone, a friend of mine, pointed out that the logo is Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And yet you've got, like, virtually every hero in the Marvel Universe is now an Avenger. Let's make it special. Originally, it was so special. You had to be special to be an Avenger. And I like that idea. Okay, let's take the best of the best, not necessarily the strongest or the most powerful, the best of the best, and let's focus on them. That way, I don't have to deal with 1,000 characters each issue, and we can have, mainly as I looked at it, I pretty much focused on one or two characters and you know, consider the others almost a supporting cast for the most part, but I tried to use every character. Okay, if I'm going to do that, let's have 6 or 7, and that's manageable, and we can make, and, you know, it changes from time to time. We brought in the Falcon and then brought in someone else. And you could have other people come in as advisors or whatever, but let's have this core group that we can really focus on and who are, you know, the best of the best. And that was my take on it. It's probably most of the reason that it was trimmed down to 7 at that issue.
You very quickly picked up on a thread that Shooter had actually introduced way back. I had forgotten this until I went back and reread Avengers 158 to 166 for the first episode of our show that David Wright and I did last week. And I was shocked to see, was his name, Django Maximoff, appear like on the last page of like 164 or something. And in the 180s, you picked up on that. Had Jim told you about that, or did you go back and read up and go, "Oh, I wonder where he was going with that"? Let's pick. How did the whole Maximoff thing come about?
Well, if you look at the credits, starting with 185, mm-hmm. I'm flipping to the back of 184. Yeah, those were like several issues that were plotted as co-plotted by Mark Gruenwald and Steve Grant. And I had taken off some time to write an Avengers paperback novel. It was published by Pocket Books back in 1979. Yeah. And they stepped in. They plotted these three stories that featured Django Maximoff and Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch. So they plotted them. So I'm assuming that's probably Mark was a huge continuity guy. You know, he knew the Marvel universe better than probably most anyone. So I'm assuming that's that was a thread that Mark wanted to continue or at least tie up. Nope. So they did the plots and I did the scripts.
Okay, all right. Well, let's talk about that for a second. You wrote The Man Who Stole Tomorrow. You have signed my copy when we got together at a convention a couple of years ago in Birmingham, and is it one of my treasures now? I love that book, and here's the funny thing about it. It's the Avengers versus Kang, more or less, right, in the future instead of in the present for once.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about it, and we talked about – David and I talked about this on the last episode, that I came onto the Avengers – around the 158-162 period, where Steve Englehart had just left the book and had done every Kang story imaginable there for a while, and so there seemed to be a sense not to have Kang reappear. So Shooter never used Kang, you didn't use Kang. I mean, you get well into the Roger Stern era before Kang comes back. So, and by that point, I had quit reading comics for a while. So the whole several years that I read The Avengers, and they became my favorite thing, I never saw a Kang story at all. The only Kang story I ever read during my entire formative years of reading comics was your Man Who Stole Tomorrow novel. And it gave me a very interesting picture of what Kang was like. And when I read the books later, the comics later, I'm like, David's version of Kang was a little different than what I, you know, seeing everywhere else. So tell us a little bit about that book and about your version of Kang, if you would.
Wow. Okay. That is, 21, 27, 37 years ago. I don't know what I was doing 37 minutes ago. I think I was talking with you, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I do remember being told somewhere by someone, editor-in-chief, about that Kang was kind of, you know, done to death in the comics.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't remember why I used him in the book. It may have been someone's suggestion, and I went and read some Kang stuff and came up with the idea. I do know I had to write that. I wrote the book in 5 weeks while I was still writing Iron Man, and I was living like 50 miles from Three Mile Island, which was melting down at the time. So it was a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, and I don't remember a lot about it, just that it was a challenge to write a novel, and I have no idea how I did it. But I don't think I can really answer your question definitively.
Well, your version of Kang, I mean, the Kang that we usually get in the comics or got back that era was sort of like Dr. Doom. I mean, he wasn't quite as arch, you know, but almost. And, you know, he was just the conqueror, whereas your version of Kang was basically crazy. He was just insane. And the Beast, of course, played off of that really well in the novel. I remember that very distinctly, that the Beast had a lot of fun with crazy Kang. So I guess I'm just wondering why you went the crazy Kang route, like he'd been driven crazy by traveling through time so much. Or I guess, does any of that stand out for you?
No, and I'm going to have to go and dig the novel out and reread it. I don't remember. I honestly, God, don't remember.
There's some really fascinating. There's like a girl with feathers that comes on a flying motorcycle. There's some really fascinating stuff that we wouldn't have seen in the comics, you know. So it stands out to me. Another thing that stands out is that, you know, because you wrote it, it reads very much like an Avengers story in the comics from that era. So I always wondered. Why? Because, you know, they did do a two-issue adaptation. I guess you wrote the adaptation, maybe, of Shooter's Ultron story in 201 and 202. And I always wanted them to do like a five-issue adaptation of The Man Who Stole Tomorrow as the comics.
Yeah, I did write that adaptation. But, yeah, well, that would be interesting. You know, they could still do it, except they probably have to give me credit, and Marvel doesn't seem to want to give me anything these days. But that's another story. Moving on.
Yeah. Well, let's see. The last things about your Avengers run, you had some interesting villains show up that we hadn't really seen before in the later period there. I mean, we had the elements of – I just list a few and then we can talk about it. You had the elements of Doom, which are kind of an interesting idea. You had the Grey Gargoyle, which was an interesting, unexpected Avengers villain, but it worked. He had just been in Thor a couple of years earlier and had given Thor and the Warriors 3 a hard time, so it makes sense he'd be a good Avengers villain. You had the Inferno in Pittsburgh. And then, of course, the Taskmaster. So let's talk about that a little bit. Were you trying to bring in some villains maybe that hadn't been seen in the Avengers before, or what was your thinking in bringing in those sort of threats?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't – I think I was just – probably I'm looking through the covers now, and I could see the Absorbing Man, and I thought I was familiar with some of these characters, and so I figured, well, okay, what could be a good menace or an interesting menace? And you know, worked out stories like from that, or I just was thinking in terms of moving the characters, and if the characters had a particularly – had a history with a particular character or had an ability that could be work off well with against a bad guy, a challenge, you know, like, you know, throw a character, I'm just making this up, a fire character go against a water villain, you know, how do they how do they solve that problem and stuff like that. I don't remember specifically, you know, except for the Taskmaster, which I created, of course, so I knew why I came up with him. But other than that, I don't really remember why I might have picked a particular character. I'd have to go back and read the books again, and maybe that would jog my memory. But offhand, that's about it.
Well, it's just an interesting run because we were seeing villains that we hadn't seen in the Avengers before. And I when I think about your run on the Avengers, one of the several things that comes to my mind is some interesting new villains, some villains that, you know, we've seen in solo books like Grey Gargoyle or Absorbing Man, but just hadn't really seen them fight the Avengers. And so I enjoyed your run for many reasons, but one was because it was fresh. I mean, we got to see these villains that we hadn't ever really seen face a whole team before do that. And that's kind of what I was thinking. So,
Probably, again, it's probably my ignorance that helped. Like, I didn't have a long history on the Avengers. So I didn't really know a lot about what had come before. So I just was looking at what I had and what was at Marvel and kind of putting them together into stories.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Taskmaster then, because everybody loves the Taskmaster. He's just a favorite. And his whole shtick is so original, the idea that he basically trains flunkies for other villains. And he's got these fascinating powers where he's like a human version of the Super Adaptoid in a way. So talk a little bit about the Taskmaster.
Okay, when I first came to Marvel and I reintroduced myself to the Marvel Universe, I saw two things that I thought needed to be explained. One of them was the fact that villains almost never succeeded, and yet they never seemed to have money problems. You know, they had all these gadgets, gimmicks, weapons, vehicles that must have cost thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And yet they're always caught and thrown in jail. Where'd the money come from? So I came up with Justin Hammer, who was a guy who financed supervillains for a cut of the take. That way, you know, he didn't have to go and, you know, rob banks or anything, but he was a financier. He was a businessman. He was, which made him a good Tony Stark villain, I thought. Mm-hmm. And he was behind, and at least when I was writing him, he was strictly behind the scenes. A guy you'd never heard of if your annual income wasn't in at least seven figures. So that was the reason it came up and explained, oh, that's where they get the money for all this stuff. The other lack that I saw was, like, all these villains seem to have these, I just realized I've got a pun coming, lackeys, who this faceless, nameless lackeys that were, you know, endless. Where'd they come from? You know, was there an ad in the Yellow Pages for Lackeys or Us, you know, rent a lackey? So where'd they come from? So I came up with Taskmaster as someone who had this ability that I call photographic reflexes. It's kind of like a photographic memory, but physical, who could do things as soon as he saw them. He could be able to emulate any kind of physical activity. But he was smart enough not to want to use it to go against superheroes because he didn't want to get beaten up. So he would train the lackeys, and that way he would make money from crime, but he wouldn't put himself, you know, in danger. He wasn't a coward. He was smart. So that's where Taskmaster came from, is to solve this empty slot that I saw in the logic of the Marvel Universe. And he's From what I understand, he's come quite a distance away from that in the past, but or more recently. But you know, that's what he was. That's why he was created. That's the purpose he was supposed to serve.
Right, and he really did. I mean, he caught on. He was popular just immediately, wasn't he? I mean, were you hearing feedback in the positive about him just about from the beginning? It seems like you would have.
Well, there was no internet then, so I didn't. All I heard was, the occasional letters to the letters page that I was occasionally sent, and at conventions or something, and most of the things you hear, are positive, because you don't usually hear the negative, So it was hard to judge, how popular something was. Because people rarely come up to you at a convention and say, "Hi, I read the Taskmaster. Boy, that sucks. Why do you do that garbage?" So it's hard to tell. But, I mean, I enjoyed the character a lot. And George Perez did just a terrific design. Guy looks really cool. So, I mean, thank you, George.
Well, I know that when we first started the Avengers mailing list back in 1996 and the Avengers website in 1995, when I was in college or graduate school and was put in the beginning of the internet, really, when all of we Avengers fans kind of came together over those mid-90s years and started talking about our favorite issues and characters, the Taskmaster always would come up as people's favorite. People just loved him and wanted more of him. And so I think he's one of the more fondly remembered things from your run, for sure. Let me see.
Good.
You wound up 198, 199 with Red Ronin, which was an interesting thing because that was a character from the Godzilla comic books. And
yeah,
that was a fun thing because I read that Godzilla series and it was so weird to have Godzilla as a character in the Marvel Universe. I mean, he fought the champions, he fought S.H.I.E.L.D. He was actively, it wasn't just like, Marvel got the Godzilla license and did like Star Wars, where the Marvel characters would never show up. You'd never see Spider-Man in an issue of Star Wars, but you saw Marvel characters in issues of Godzilla. So it was almost like Godzilla was just a bigger Hulk rampaging through the desert and all the characters out there trying to stop him. So how did you wind up getting one of the Godzilla supporting characters as a villain in Avengers? That always just struck me as kind of out of left field. I was like, whoa, Red Ronin.
Yeah, well, left field is one of my favorite place to be. I like being there and taking stuff from it. Where it came from, I don't know. I honestly don't. It's just I'm looking at the issues and there's no plot credit for anyone else. So apparently, I came up with it myself, but. I know I wanted to do a story about someone who, with this extreme viewpoint of war, who is so afraid of war, has been afraid all his life of war, that he just wanted to get it over with. So he wanted to start like World War III, just so he wouldn't have to live with all this fear of the upcoming war. I thought that was an interesting, twisted sort of viewpoint. And, Red Ronin seemed, maybe someone suggested when I was talking to him about, Red Ronin's this big thing, it could start a war. I don't know. I don't remember if after all this time that was the reason I did those stories, but the big red robot, I don't know where I came up with that.
Well, the cover blurb on 199 sums up what you were just saying, because it says the madness within Red Ronin.
Correct, yeah.
So you're right. It really was more about the person driving him. He could have been just a big tank or something, right? It was about the intent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've never noticed this before, by the way, but on the cover of 198, they spell it Ronan, like the accuser. And on the cover of 199, they spell it Ronin, like the samurai. So he's got two different versions. I'd never noticed.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, and I never knew that until you mentioned it. That is, Yeah, on the inside of 198, it's in the title, it's R-O-N-I-N. So I guess it was just someone who wrote the cover copy and the proofreader missed it. I don't know. That's interesting.
They
learn something new every day.
They must have been thinking about the Kree character, because that's how you spell him. So,
Could be.
All right.
Could be.
Well, we gotta touch on this one. I hang on to something firm now. We'll go there as
I think I know where.
Huh?
I think I know where you're going. Okay.
Yeah, as long or as briefly as you want to, but certainly no more controversial issue than 200. And I liked how somebody put it this way. I'm trying to think where I saw this. They said David Michelinie is such a great writer that when you read that issue and just read his scripting, you just loved it. And it's only later when Chris Claremont comes back and points out certain things about the plot that you go, oh, well, that is problematic. But it was so smooth and everything was so nicely written that people at first didn't notice that there might be something controversial to it. What do you think about that? Because I think that's true.
I want to find out who said that and shake their hand. it was – okay, I've explained this before. I'll explain it for your listeners. I had come up with an idea, and it had been set up in the previous issues. After issue 200 had been plotted, and at least 198 had been maybe even published. I mean, the deadlines were so close on these books of those days. But everything had been drawn, everything. I did the plot. And after I'd done the plot for 200, another comic comes out from Marvel, published with exactly that same story. Now, I won't mention any names because I don't know if it was, you know, strictly coincidence. It's awfully, awfully close to be a coincidence. Yeah. But there's a chance that, you know, people were talking about this, my story around the office. Someone heard it. A few days later, they had to come up with a story, and they didn't realize they had taken my story. But basically, we couldn't do the story I did plotted for issue 200. We couldn't do the conclusion for what was set up because it had already been done almost exactly in another book that was published. So if you'll check the credits, there are four credits: Jim Shooter, George Perez, Bob Layton, and David Michelinie for plot. That plot was done like in an hour or two in a round robin session with these four people. What can we do that's different but will still match what was set up?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, you know, looking back, would I have done something different? Sure. We did. It was desperation. We had to have something. It had to go to press. It had to be drawn. Had to go to the printer. And it had to follow somewhat logically what had been set up. We had no other choice. So we came up with a story. It seemed to work. It came out. I wrote it. I'm glad that it worked for some people as far as the script. I did the best I could. We all did the best we could under very difficult circumstances. And, you know, if people were offended, it was not our intention. You know, like I say, if we had had more time to work, if I had more time to redo it, it would have been different, but we did the best we could under some very difficult circumstances.
Sure. So what was your reaction then when the number 10 annual came out that was sort of the counterpoint to it? Did you read it at the time?
I've never read it.
Okay.
No, I've never read it. Was that the one that Chris wrote?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I had been told that he had kind of negated everything that was done and in kind of a way that was kind of derogatory or whatever. I don't want to read it. You know, if people, you know, someone wants to come on and say something about my work that, you know, they didn't like it or they want to negate everything, they want to do something different, it was wrong. Okay, that's their privilege. You know, like I say, I did the best I could under the circumstances. I can't, you know, buy a time machine on eBay and go back and change it. So it's there. And, you know, my name's on it. I took a check. You know, I'll take the brick bats if they're thrown.
Well, you know, one interesting thing about 200 is that a lot, I don't know if I was the only one thinking this, but I was imagining that since we had not had a Kang story since before I started reading the book when I was little, back in the 140s, I kept thinking, man, it's been like 60 issues since we've had a Kang story. Surely we're going to get a Kang story in 200. And that was what I was disappointed about as a kid reading it. It wasn't Kang. But in retrospect, it kind of was a Kang story, wasn't it? In a way.
I haven't read it since then, and I don't know. I'm looking through the pages and...
Well, I mean, because Marcus Immortus is you know, connected to Immortus, and Immortus turns out to be one of many versions of Kang, you know, along with Rama Tut and everything. So it kind of is Kang in a way, sort of, kind of.
Okay. Okay. I meant to do that, yeah.
So I remember thinking, you know, he kind of did sneak a Kang story in there, just under a different name. So, I'm trying to think if there was any. I know that after 202, when you adapted that short story that Shooter did on Ultron, The Evil Undying, Evil Reborn, I mean, certainly, I want to ask you about that first. Shooter, I think, is sort of the master of the Ultron story. And we just talked on our last episode, David and I, about 160, 161, 162, which is the Bride of Ultron story. I mean, Shooter brought kind of just a menace to Ultron that he'd never really had before as just this robot villain. He became truly frightening. And so did you read Shooter's short story, and how did it come about that you ended up adapting it as a two-part comic book?
I don't know. I had read it. Yes, it was part of the same series of pocketbooks that I wrote the Avengers novel for. I think I asked Jim if I could adapt it, and he said sure. So I think that's where that came from. So I think I set it up. Yeah, in issue 201, and then did the full length adaptation in 202 because I thought it was a good story, you know. So I was happy to adapt it. It fit well, I thought.
Yeah, those of us on the old Avengers mailing list used to talk about how do you get rid of Ultron, and they had done various different things, and this is the one where you basically freeze him inside a block of adamantium, so he's still himself intact. He's just like a cube, so he can't do anything. So, did you ever come up with any other creative ways of dealing with Ultron, or would you think that was pretty much the best? Or what do you think about that?
I'm asking you about my history now. Did I ever write Ultron in any other stories in Iron Man or Avengers? Do you know?
I don't remember you doing him. No, I mean maybe so. Others have better memories of this too than me, but
I don't remember.
Just you use a lot of different new villains. You didn't really go back and kind of revisit a lot of old Avengers villains. So I don't, other than 201, 202, I have a hard time thinking of a story like that.
Well, I probably didn't. So I probably never thought of any other way to dispose of Ultron. I assume the cube of adamantium was what was in Jim's short story. If I never wrote the character again, I doubt that I ever thought of him again.
Yeah. Yeah. He would have been an interesting Iron Man villain. He had such a connection to Iron Man, right? I mean, obviously, even though he's kind of Pym's son in a way, I think in that story, Iron Man is the one that rebuilds him because apparently he'd left a hypnotic suggestion in Tony's brain to rebuild him at some point. And so it would have been interesting to see what you and Bob Layton would have done with Ultron in an Iron Man story.
Well, when they bring us back for a third run on Iron Man, we'll think about it.
Oh, Marvel, I hope you're listening. Please do. Please, please. So did you write – I'm trying to think. Now, after this point, I kind of lost out on the Avengers a little bit. Jim Shooter came back for his second run where he court-martialed Yellow Jacket and everything. Did you ever do Avengers again after that, or was that pretty much the end?
Well, 205 was my last regular issue.
Okay.
I came back and did 221 over a Jim Shooter plot.
Oh, yeah.
That was during his run. And then I wrote 223, which has one of my favorite covers ever, a Hannigan-Jansen cover of that they kind of use in the Ant-Man movie, a Hawkeye with Ant-Man on the tip of an arrow about to shoot it.
Yes.
And that was my last actual writing. My name appears, ironically enough, in issue 340. As the plotter, and the story behind that is that I had done a story, I had written a full script story for the drawer, we say, for inventory, in case you need to plug it in, and I'd forgotten about it, and then years later, I got a small royalty check for an issue of Avengers, like 340, and my last issue was 223, so my God, over 100 issues, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. So I dug out the stacks, and sure enough, there's my name in the credits, and it turns out the editor had decided to use it, but had someone else come in and totally rewrite it. I have no idea why. I had some issues with the particular editor, so maybe he just didn't want to deal with me. Maybe he didn't like the story. Maybe it didn't fit continuity. But I was not contacted to, you know, either told or to participate. So it was a big surprise to me, and my name's on it, but I wish I could take no credit for it. And that's it for me in the Avengers.
Well, let's see, a couple other things before we wrap up, and I've kept you far too long, but I appreciate it. We're going to do two episodes out of this, so this is great. But I'll just a couple more.
Oh, do I get paid twice for it?
Yeah, look, the check will be in the mail. Let's see. David Wright, my co-host in the last episode, pointed out something that I had not realized, that you and Paul Ryan were the only creators to work on the wedding issues of both Spider-Man and Superman.
That's true, I think. Yeah.
Isn't that neat? So you wrote Spider-Man for quite a while. Tell a little bit about what it was about, you know, your affinity for Spider-Man and what it was like to write such an iconic character for so long.
Well, as much as I'd like to say Iron Man was my favorite Marvel character, Spider-Man was my favorite Marvel character. It's what got me interested in comics in my, quote, adult, unquote, years. I had stopped reading comics in 1962 because I was 14 years old and I decided it's time to grow up. I gave away my comics collection, which is probably worth $1 million now, and I stopped reading comics. Then I was in college. I was a sophomore, and I was playing in a rock band, and I was sitting on a, what do you call it, a not a trunk. Oh, God, I can never remember this word. There's a, shoot. What do Army people have that they keep, you know, a box, they open it up?
Locker?
Foot locker. Ta-da! I should have thought of tennis shoes. Anyway, I was sitting on this foot locker in the guy's room, in his office room thingy, and he had to look. I had given up comics. The guy, our bass player, was a year older than me. He was 21. I was 20. And he had to get something out of the foot locker, so I got up and he opened it, and it was full of comic books. I thought, you read comics? He said, oh, yeah, Marvel comics. They're great. Spider-Man, especially, he's like a real guy. You know, he's not, you know, just things don't go well for him. He's like a real person. You know, he runs to catch an elevator, and the doors close before he gets there. He's trying to flag a cab down in a rainstorm. A cab goes by and sloshes him. It's like you or I. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went to my local convenience store, and in the spinner rack, they had two issues of Spider-Man. They're in the 60s, like 64 and 65, something like that. And I read them, and I was blown away. I thought, wow, this is comic books now? This is great. And I became a Spider-Man fan and a Marvel fan right then. So Spider-Man was my all-time favorite character. As much as I genuinely loved writing Iron Man, it was a thrill to write Spider-Man. I web was Spider-Man first, and when I was moved over to Amazing Spider-Man, it was like, okay, you can't get any better than this. I'm writing my favorite character ever and my favorite comic book ever.
Wow.
And that's one of the reasons I stayed on as long as I did. Is that it was just, oh, well, some guy, Todd something or another, was the artist on that, and I forget. You know, he's faded into obscurity, Todd McSomething or another.
Yeah.
was part of it, because writing from his pictures, scripting from his pictures was just so much fun. But I loved writing Spider-Man. It was you know, a dream job. So that's why I stayed on that. For that length of time. Have I answered your question?
Yes, absolutely. And a couple things.
Oh, okay.
How did you never end up using Spidey and Iron Man then? Or maybe you did in the second run and I just don't remember, but you did in the first run.
No, I didn't. Well, I hadn't written Spider-Man then. I was just Iron Man and Avengers. It was before I wrote Spider-Man. So,
but I mean,
waiting now for my...
How did you not ever want to get Spider-Man as I mean, like we talked about before, you had the Hulk, you had Submariner. How did you not ever get Spider-Man as a guest appearance for an issue or two? That would have been interesting.
It would have, but I don't, like I said, I was co-playing with Bob Layton then, and I don't know, I guess it never came up.
Mm.
I'm pretty sure, I'm looking through the titles on my second run, and After the Ghost, Neutron Wars, Kleoska, blah, 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 blah. Stark Wars got a glitch, blah, 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 blah. I don't know if I ever did. I know I wrote a prose story with Iron Man and Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. I was doing a what if. What if Tony Stark had become Iron Man, one of the few things I've written at Marvel in the last 20 years. And the editor asked me if I'd want to do a short story, a prose story for Spider-Man magazine, and maybe use Iron Man. So I did. So that's the only time that I remember, you know, putting them together. Although there may have been, you know, a comic book story somewhere, but I can't remember at this particular point.
Yeah, yeah, I don't either. So Venom, tell us a little bit about Venom.
Venom, my old pal. Sure. What would you like to know?
How did he come about? Did you think that Spidey needed a new, like, major rival type villain, or did he evolve organically, or what?
Yeah. Well, I whenever I write a character, I try to use the unique elements of that character as much as possible. So when I was in control of writing Spider-Man's, choreographing his fight stuff, I tried to use, you know, his webbing, his acrobatics, his sticking to walls, his spider sense, all of the unique elements of the character, and his strength too, and his brain, of course. But I thought, okay, the one unique element that at that time had never been used by another character was his spider sense. So I'm thinking around, what if there was a villain who didn't trigger his spider sense? What if there was a villain who just sole purpose was to kill Spider-Man, was totally focused on that, and he didn't trigger the spider sense, because the spider sense had become a reflex. Spider-Man, Peter Parker, didn't even think about it. When it tingled, he jumped. What if he never had that warning? What would it do to his self-confidence? What would it do to him emotionally? And it had been established that the alien symbiote from Secret Wars did not trigger Peter Parker's spider sense. So I thought, okay, what if there's a bad guy who uses the symbiote and that doesn't trigger Peter Parker's spider sense? So I came up with this. Originally, it was a woman. I had come up with an origin. There was going to be this woman who was pregnant, and she's gone into labor. Her husband takes her out, tries to flag down a cab to take her to the hospital. I was going to tie it in with the graphic novel called Revenge of the Living Monolith, where Spider-Man is fighting the living monolith, this huge thing over Manhattan. The cabbie was looking up at Spider-Man, didn't see the guy in the street flagging him down. He hits the husband, kills the husband. The woman goes into shock, has a miscarriage, and she goes into a catatonic state. When she comes out of the catatonic state, all she remembers is that the deaths of her husband and unborn child were caused by Spider-Man. She blames Spider-Man. So she goes to this chapel where it had been established the symbiote had been removed from Spider-Man. The symbiote senses her hatred of Spider-Man, bonds with her, and she becomes a villain that tries to kill Spider-Man. Well, I set that up in two little subplot scenes in Web of Spider-Man, one in which Peter Parker is standing at a subway station. As the train arrives, a hand comes in, pushes him in front of the train. Of course, he leaps out in time, but he's shaken up because his spider sense didn't tingle, didn't warn him. And then in another story that someone else ended up scripting, Spider-Man's on the side of a building, a hand comes out a window, grabs his ankle, throws him off the building. And again, it didn't trigger his spider sense. So when I was switched over to Amazing, editor Jim Salicrup wanted to do something special for issue 300, suggested creating a new character, a hero or a villain. I told him about this villain that I had been coming up with in Web of Spider-Man. He liked it, but at the time, he didn't think readers might have a problem accepting a female character standing toe-to-toe against Spider-Man. So I changed it to a male, gave it a new origin with Eddie Brock, with him being a reporter that had some questionable practices and ended up losing his job because of a story he had printed involving Spider-Man, which wasn't true and was proven untrue. So he blamed Spider-Man for losing his job, the fact that he couldn't get work except writing for for tabloids just spewing venom about everything. That's where he got his name. And so that became the villain that was going into Spider-Man. The whole purpose of the villain of this character was to show someone whose total focus was killing Spider-Man, but didn't trigger his spider sense, and what that would do to Spider-Man mentally.
Yeah, that's really...
The end.
I love the idea of where the venom... I'd never heard that, I don't think, that the name came from actually like a metaphor, like, you know, like that it's a reporter spewing venom. That's really cool.
I don't think I ever ended put that into a dialogue or a caption. I probably should have. But because, yeah, it would help making sense.
That's a really great idea. That's really cool. Okay, well, I think we've about covered... Oh, the one thing I didn't ask you about. We talked about the Iron Man movie and movies and the and Ant-Man movie. So we're talking about the Avengers now. What has been your thoughts about the two Avengers movies? I mean, are you pleased overall, or what do you think?
I liked the first one a lot. The second one... I liked both of them. I liked the first one better than the second one. I'm trying to think, because I'm now seeing in my mind Civil War.
Yeah.
It was a Captain America, but it was really an Avengers movie, let's face it.
It was.
So, there were some things that I, overall, I liked it. You know, I liked the first one a lot, but I liked the second one. I've enjoyed most of the Marvel movies, actually. On some level, some better than others, but yeah. I'd have to give them both thumbs up.
I guess with the Ultron one, it just to some degree it seemed like they were trying to do so much that a lot of it didn't need to be in there, or it just felt like it was overstuffed. Maybe, I mean, as a writer, does it?
I think. Go ahead.
I just say, as a writer, does it come across that way to you?
Well, I think that may have been one of the things that that I wasn't thrilled with, because I thinking back, I have to kind of like, okay, what was the second movie about? Oh, Ultron. Okay, was this movie? And it's like the first one seemed to be more clearly focused on the characters and the events than in the second one. I remember it more, and maybe because they were just trying to do too much stuff. So that seems like a valid. I don't know if you're criticism, but valid observation.
Okay. Well, I think I've pretty much worn out every question I could think of and that David could think of to ask you. So is there anything you have going on now you want to mention that people should be on the lookout for in the days to come?
Well, I've recently had a couple of prose short stories published in by small press publishers. There's one called... Singularity, Rise of the Posthumans, which is kind of it's from Pro Se Press. It's kind of a steampunk superhero anthology, shared world anthology. I like kind of like the story I had in that. And one maybe of more interest to comic book readers was called Super Swingin' 1968 Heroes Special. I think that's the name of it. It's basically an homage to 1968 comic book, a 1960s comic book characters altered just enough to keep from getting lawsuits. And it's I have a story in that. And so that's out from Mechanoid Press. So they're both available from Amazon.com, everybody. Not plugging them, but hey.
No.
And there's a graphic novel that I did with a Spanish artist named Cesar Madaro. I met him in Spain about 2 or 3 years ago. We did this graphic novel called The Lunoir Saga, which has no dialogue in it, which is interesting. And it's we signed contracts with Maximum Comics, I think it is. It's a company out of Mexico City. They're going to put it up on an internet accessible site. I think it's for subscriptions or something. There's some pay involved. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's called Geekflix. And then hopefully get a print edition of that out sometime after that. So that's about it for what I have out and coming out that I know of. Thank you for asking.
No, absolutely. Okay. Well, I'm sure that our listeners have really enjoyed these two episodes talking to you, and I just want to thank you so much for taking the time out to listen to me just rant and rave about how great your stuff is and how it was just a defining you know, it's sort of the defining text of it along with Shooter stuff and Starlin stuff from that period is just what, you know, formed my impression of how a comic book and how comic book characters and stories should be written. So it just has meant the world to get to kind of talk to you and pick your brains a little bit about how it all came about. And I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the interest. It's immensely flattering. I mean, there are people who say, well, writing comic books isn't brain surgery. And maybe it isn't. But, you know, how many brain surgeons have someone come up 30 years after they've been operating? So, did I tell you how much I enjoyed that incision? You know, it's very flattering that people are still interested in the stuff that I've done. That I have to thank you.
Well, we'll let you get on with your business, but this will be episodes 2 and 3, I believe, of our brand new Avengers Assemble podcast from White Rocket Entertainment. And I hope that everybody's enjoyed it. And so we will let David go now. All right. I want to thank David again so much for coming on the show and for being so generous with his time to spend such a long time talking about this stuff. It was an absolute treat for me, and I'm sure for you guys as well. That's going to do it for another episode of the Avengers Assemble podcast. Don't forget to visit www.whiterocketbooks.com. You can pick up copies of Assembled and Assembled 2, the two books that we Jarvis heads of AvengersAssembled.net put together about the Avengers history. You can also pick up Super Comics Trivia, a book that compiles all the questions from the first 10 years of the Super Marvel DC Trivia Jeopardy contest that we hosted at Dragon Con for over the years and still do. And otherwise, you can find quite a lot of other good stuff there. So www.whiterocketbooks.com. That's going to do it. All that remains to be said is Avengers Assemble.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.